So, Apologetics Academy, thinking through what we mean by apologetics, what we talked about like in November, like that's why I was asking if people who hadn't been here maybe heard it online, just to set the scene about that. What we're trying to do with the Apologetics Academy, the idea is in the American Catholic landscape, there's a lot of high voice, there's the theologians, and they have dissertations, and they argue about these things. And then there's a lot of the low voice, and I don't mean that derogatorily, I mean this in more like a sort of a Greek rhetorical sense, right? There's the basics, right? So there's a lot of programming, either for kids, for high schoolers, or for people who are just starting their faith. But what we're missing a lot of is what I'm going to call the middle voice, the voice that takes that next step. Okay, I know the basics really well, but I'm not going to go be a theologian because I don't want to make that little money and have that little influence. So what do I do, though, if I want to grow past just the beginning? So we talk about the middle voice. And apologetics, I really do think, is a good field for lay people who are trying to grow in their faith and attain something like the middle voice. We all don't need to misconstrue what God is asking of us as if we're all supposed to be amateur theologians, because that's just doing what theologians do for even less money, right? But there's a way in which we are all supposed to be witnesses, right? St. Peter says we are supposed to witness the hope that is within us. And so that's not becoming, like I said, intellectuals that can throw down with anyone at any time for any debate. And it's not necessarily even winning arguments per se. But how do we witness to this faith in a way that's more than basic? Now, you will find in your life, and you guys probably, if you're here, have already done that. There's been times when people just have basic questions. What are the three theological virtues? Faith, hope, and love. Why are they different than cardinal ones? And I mean, even if you guys don't know every single detail, I'm sure everyone in this room knows, well, I can go to the catechism, or I know where I can go, or who I can ask in order to get questions to answer those primary fundamental questions. But we also know that I'm sure we've all experienced that that's not what's holding most people back from the faith. They're like, for 50 years, I just wanted to hear what the third theological virtue was, and no one said charity. And then finally, Bo said it, and I'm a Catholic now. That's usually not what happens, right? In fact, many of the people that we are probably going to find ourselves conversing, we have to maybe blush a bit to think that they might know the faith even better than we do, as if we're talking about sort of basic fundamentals, knowledge, the sort of things that people would ask questions and we could give trivia-type answers back to. So this middle voice is what I think apologetics, that we need to get at. How do we make an apology for our faith? And just to reiterate that this is the Greek form of the term, so we're not apologizing like we mean, like we're saying sorry. The apologia in the Greek is a defense. So when we think of, when we have in mind making an apology for the faith, we should have in mind Socrates' apology, or even Jesus before Pilate, a far more mysterious apology. But it's not apologizing for the faith, making a defense. Thomas Aquinas, everything that he does is an apology for the faith. Yes. But lucky for us, we all don't need to write summas or memorize the summa. but when we start to think about apologetics this way, I think that we begin to go into maybe a different mode about how are we often going to be doing apologetics with people who are not in the faith. What is our role, so to speak, in that, the questions they might have, or their relationship to the church, things like this. And one of them will be answering questions for them, that's no doubt. But in a way, like I said, I'm confident looking at the people here, most of us know either the answers ourselves or we know where to find the most basic ones. What we maybe have wrestled with is, what can we do to be a conduit of God's grace, drawing them closer, you know, bringing them over the finish line, or being the occasion for them to think deeper than a pamphlet would allow them to think. And I'm not going to deny this, like Lighthouse, the pamphlets we have at front, there are too many people who have converted because they've simply read one. So again, do not hear me complaining about those or acting like they're not worthwhile. But I think we all know either Catholics who've fallen away from the faith, Christians of other denominations, or people who are just interested in the faith, but seem like they never really want to make that jump. And it's not a lack of knowledge, it seems like it's something else. And what I have in mind for December and bringing up Dante's Inferno, beyond the fact that Father Yurok from the pulpit said, Bo's going to teach something about Dante's Inferno in December, so I feel like I'm sort of bound to. Beyond that, I'm thinking about how this goes into an apologetics academy. How can we use literature as apologetics? So there's a few things in a matter of preambles, and I know that preamble sounds a lot like ramble, so you know, forgive me if that's what it sounds like at first. But there's things I think we need to consider first before we even get to considering how you would use something like Dante's Inferno in apologetics. And one of them is about the nature of apologetics itself. It lends itself, when we start saying that an apologetics is a defense of the faith, it lends itself to martial imagery, like that you're having a fight, or you're having an argument, or you're crossing swords, or things like this. And many people have pointed out, rightfully so, I think I brought this up in November, that the point of apologetics, of course, is not to win arguments. But it's also because the main point of apologetics is not to provide the right answers. Funny enough, I think the main thing you can do when engaging in apologetics with other people outside the faith is, instead of worrying so much about the right answers, is to worry about the right questions that you make them start to have. That is infinitely more important than any one answer you might give. Now, it might be an answer, it might be a whole host of things, but the people who are on this verge that we're talking about, where it's not just simple confusion keeping them from the faith, oftentimes the leap they need to make is someone finally made them wrestle with a question that they were avoiding. I think of my own conversion at Protestant seminary. That's a lot of what it was. Because very early on, you can go read, especially if you're getting a master's degree in theology, you read the ancient church fathers, you read all this theology, and you can do really brilliant things with your mind, like call yourself a Catholo-Methodist, a word I made up back in 2003 and 2004 to avoid asking what? The real question. I knew the answers, but did I ask myself the real question? And that's the sort of spiritual conversion. I usually tell people I have sort of an intellectual conversion, but the spiritual conversion is what waited till later. And that's when I had to ask myself the real question. So apologetics, in many ways, is usually not you answering questions. Yes, you have to defend it. To seem credible, you either have to be able to say, I know the answer, or I know where to get it. True. I think most of you are capable of that. It's also not necessarily that, like, you make a really great question, right? Like, you beat them, like, ha-ha, never thought of that. Because, you know, and there's something about the martial imagery and, like, a fight that makes it sound like the point is winning. To tweak the metaphor a bit, the point of apologetics is not to win, but to wound. What I mean is, if you wound them in the right way, right? Pope Benedict XVI talked about the wound of beauty, right? That beauty, like, first encounter, it makes our heart bleed in a certain way, that it just keeps bothering us, and it wells up until finally we have to consider the question of, why is the world beautiful? So he was saying that the wound of beauty. My contention for you is apologetics, in many ways, is an exercise in wounding. It's less parlaying and striking well, but the wound. Do you make them ask the right questions? And that's what we're after. And so there's all sorts of things that apologetic contains. Do we answer questions we need to? Are we friendly to people who need to be friendly? Are we, you know, appropriately forward with the people who need to be forward? Talked about this last time in the November session, that will depend on us judging, are they strangers? Do they know us? If I'm, like, tried to, like, talk to my brother about coming to the faith, and all of a sudden it's like, Bobby, I want to talk to you about the faith. After 5 minutes before that, ribbing him mercilessly, because that's what us brothers do, you know, he's not going to, like, switch the mode. He'll think I'm trying to sell him insurance or something, right? So beyond the fact of there's little things, understanding the rhetorical situation, who we're dealing with, I want to consider that literature like many other arts, but we're going to consider literature, is a prime way to do apologetics if we stop acting like apologetics is just providing answers instead of realizing that what we're trying to do is make them ask the right questions. But to do that, we need to read literature correctly, because too many of us, and I don't mean just us here, I mean how most people who still read, if they do, if you read more than Twitter, more than 140 characters, many of us still have the mindset that when you read, you're reading for information. We will read everything from the Bible to Dante to Reader's Digest to whatever as if it's a VCR manual. Give me the answers. Tell me what you're trying to say. And so people will come to classes about Dante and they'll go like, Bo, just tell us what it's about. And so then I like being a Turk and going like, ah, hell, you know, hell and poets. No, tell us what it's about. Why do everybody think it's a big deal? I'm like, no, like there's this poet in hell. It's great. No, just tell us. And you know, someone brought up Cliff Notes. I think you did. Part of the thing is, like, I don't blame students. I just got done grading, so this is heavy on my mind. I don't blame students who think that what teachers want is the Cliff Note version of whatever we had them read. We make it sound that way. We make it sound like, Jimmy, I just want you to tell me what blank is about. What information went from over here, boop, into your head, reproduce that. So students do that. Now, as much as, like, I have the reputation of being an old, young curmudgeon, you know, traditionalist or whatever, when it comes to grades, I'm almost an out-and-out hippie because I'm not so worried about how great they're going to be writing papers. The secret is it's because I'm a pessimist and I don't think any of them write well. But I'm far less worried about them being proficient and great, and I'm far more worried if they just wrestled with it. Just if they wrestled with it. To me, a class in philosophy and theology and literature, the proof that you did a good job is if they leave confused. Because 20-year-olds need a bit of confusion going on, right? Because plenty of them think they have it figured out. I know I did. And what the best teachers did was confuse me and confound me rather than give me the answers. And if you think it's just me being a turkey, our Lord does the same. Lord, why do you speak in parables? So that some may hear but not listen. Some may hear but not listen. Sometimes apologetics is you being the person that gives them the occasion to hear but not listen. So again, somewhere down the line, they ask themselves the right question. Literature, if we act like it's just a manual or a dictionary or an encyclopedia, you really start to wonder, why not just do the Cliff Notes? Why not just read Wikipedia? If what's most important is I know the details about what Dante and Virgil discover as they go through the Inferno, why not just go catch up real quick on the short end of it, right? So then when I start saying, oh, do you remember when Dante and Virgil, they meet so-and-so in this ring of hell? And you go, yeah, I do. And we go, yay, we know it together. Let's have a cookie. You know, right. So I start to understand why kids are really nihilistic about this whole humanity stuff. Because if we teach it like that, like it's just things you should know, they want to go, how will this help me get a job? When do I need to bring up the eighth circle of hell when I'm a nurse? It'd be interesting to think, but it probably doesn't come up much. And so, yeah, we're humanities people, we sit up there and we make our own jobs sound like they're not worth it. And the same thing, Catholics will even do this with our best literature. We'll go, oh, do you really want to know something about the Catholic faith? Well, you really need to read the Dante's Inferno. Why? Because it's right. Because it has all the answers. And I think about most of the great Catholic literature, and what a lot of it doesn't do is just spoon-feed answers. Because I could go around and ask you all what your favorite book is. A lot of them are about confusion. Evelyn Waugh, Brideshead Revisited. You get done, you're like, well, that's confusing. And I think about it for months, right? You can think about Homer or Virgil. You can just think about the endings of the greatest books. Hamlet. Why does Hamlet end the way it does? And I think the answer is to confuse you. Because those confusing things that barb your head, that stay in your soul longer, they're going to be the things that make you ask questions. Literature needs to be thought of this way. Another way I like to put it, too many of us read like we're taxidermists. Yeah, it's always end up being about slaughtering beef at some point to me. What we act like is that like we take the book and we stuff it with meaning, and then we put it up on the shelf like it's a trophy, right? Yeah, there's the Iliad. I read it last year. I know what it means. I'm done now. And what that means is when you do that, you never read the Iliad again because you read it. You stuffed it with meaning and you're done. But the great books, what's the one thing all great books have in common? Ambiguity. Well, it's less than ambiguity. It's that we just keep reading them. That they can be read again and again and again. How many times have you heard the same stories from the Bible from this pulpit? Yearly. And the thing is, why is the Bible the greatest book? Why would we Catholics argue this so? Because you can hear the same story over and over again. And if you've been trained well, you will hear something different every time. That doesn't mean it's relative. It means that it's multifaceted. It's larger than any one person's hearing. And each time the Word of God confronts us in Scripture, it has something new to teach us. So when we go look at literature like that, instead of the taxidermical novel model where we're just stuffing it with meaning, but instead we're letting the literature we're reading, the book, be a master. Like we're going to submit to the book. We're going to be the apprentice to the master of the book. We're going to let the book rule us and not us rule the book. We can start to see where literature is a great conduit to make people ask the right questions rather than provide the best answers. Because again, if literature is just about providing answers, another thing that I constantly hear from kids is correct. What does this have to do with my life? Why is this relevant? Why aren't we reading something that was put out in the last 5 years? What does this Italian guy in the Middle Ages have anything to do with me? And I'm like, you're right, he talks very little about texting in the Inferno. It hardly shows up at all. However, Dante asks certain questions that nearly 1,000 years on, we all have to ask ourselves those questions. We all have to keep asking them. So it seems to me there's one particular way that we shouldn't use literature for apologetics. There's something like 5 ways which we can, but 2 that I specifically want to talk about today. So obviously the one way that we shouldn't use literature as apologetics is to act like to hand someone a book and say, read this, it has all the information. When you get done and you get done with the back cover, you'll be a Catholic. The end. Because nothing, and I know that you wouldn't say those words as much, but I've seen people do this. Like, you know what, if you just read blank, I don't care who you are, you'll want to go into RCIA. And people take the book and they hold it like this, and they never read it. Or if they do, they're all like, oh yeah, I'm look at the Catholic here, you know. You're like, if you're acting like you're an adult who's just dumb, but here's the book that will fill you all in, that's not apologetics. How does using literature as apologetics work? Well, there's several ways. Some we're more in control of than others. One way is, and I've heard too many people convert this way, so I can't poo-poo on it, if someone comes up, hey, Bo, I know you go to church. Can you just tell me a book that I should read to learn about the faith? And you're like, I was just thinking about paying my bills. How about Dante's Inferno? Okay. And then they convert. You know what? That hardly has anything to do with you. That's just God. So we really can't break that one down. Okay, so set that one to the side. Like the St. Augustine, right? Tole, like take up and read. Okay, God can use you in miraculous ways, but it's not a plan. Okay. The second way you can use books, something like apologetics, thinking particularly about Dante. So Eastern Orthodox journalist Rod Dreher has recently, I think it was last year, put a book called How Dante Saved My Life. And it's got quite a bit of press, especially for a book that has the word Dante on it. Sold quite a few books. Now, it is a very personal, emotional take on why Rod Dreher thinks that reading Dante and learning about Dante literally changed problems he had in his life. It is a very intense, emotional book. But again, it almost is not repeatable. I can't tell you all that Dante will be like that for you. You might have a book that's like that, that you're that emotionally invested into, that like had that much change in your life. And telling someone about that book might end up being apologetics, because they look at you and they're like, this person had such a change of heart over one book. You know, maybe I should read that book, or maybe there's a book in my life I should reapproach, etc., etc. But again, it's not really repeatable. I can't tell you to go out and have a heart on fire for Dante, because you might not. People's opinions differ. And the other problem with this as an apologetics method is people might just not like Dante. I don't know what's wrong with those people. I love Dante. But no. But I mean, you know, so if we make it, if it's very personal and emotional, it can be very powerful, but it's not as repeatable. So it's a second method, but again, one that doesn't, we shouldn't really dwell on too much. A third one is what sort of already happens here at Blessed Sacrament, where the book is not so much you utilizing it to people outside of the community, but the book strengthens the community, making them better Catholics and thus better at apologetics. People who would just take the time, like if we did a book club and we did the Inferno, which would probably not happen, but you could do it if you wanted. Reading great literature is really important, especially for people who know the faith and believe it, but maybe don't have the sort of the depth they want to be able to even imagine it in their own minds. And what I mean by this is there's plenty of people that have absolutely no problem with the faith, indeed are on fire for the faith, but if you ask them to defend the faith, the most of the defense would consist of but those people that are somehow not like part of the church, heaven is full of people with a simple faith that if people ask, why do you believe, their best answer would be, I just know. And there's, like I said, more people like that in heaven than people who can sit up here at a podium and yap for a while. Amen. But for those people, if they want maybe a chance to grow in their ability to imagine why they have this so sure a faith, something like reading like Dante's Inferno or many of the other Catholic or even maybe some other literature with Catholic friends is an immeasurably good way to grow in an apologetic spirit. So if any of you want to start a book club, I would very much encourage you to read Dante's Inferno. I think, just the whole comedy if you want. I think Anthony Esselin, he's actually going to come here next year to the Catholic Culture Conference out at Spiritual Life Center in April. He has a wonderful translation that has really good notes that you might have to draw out a map to keep all your Italian politicians straight. But I think you would largely get what's going on and why he thinks certain people are being punished the way they are. The last two things are really what I think, if we're going to talk about an apologetics academy, how in apologetics we can use literature in a profitable way, and things like Dante's Inferno and others. One is, it is incredibly hard to convince anyone, even if you can spout the utter exact niceties of a doctrine, it's hard for people to imagine life differently than how they're currently living it. So if you're going to go and talk to someone about some aspect of the faith, whether it's one that runs very counterculturally, like our understanding of contraception and sexuality, or even if it's something like, why Sunday? Why rest? Why is peace important? I mean, things where people aren't even really arguing with us, they're just like, why does it have to be Sunday? You can be like, oh, well, that's the Lord's Day, the eighth day of creation. Okay, but why Sunday? And you're like, well, you know, you got to rest from your labors, give it to God. And they're like, well, I rest all the time. I do it so well, I sleep through church. Like we you know. So it's really hard for people to like imagine what we mean when we say stuff that's second nature to us. So we go, no, you know, the problem with lust is not just that it's naughty or bad, but that it really starts to take away your autonomy. It starts to burrow deep in your soul. It starts to make other things more difficult. You stop being in control of yourself. And you tell people in 2015 this, and they're like, no. When I do what you're calling lustful, that's me most in control, most myself. That's what I want to do. I'm answering exactly the desires I want. You want me to not answer them. You want me to be something different. And we get at loggerheads, and they don't understand what we're talking about. And you can argue, but sometimes what they need is a vision of how the whole thing looks different. And that is a place where literature can bridge a gap in a way that even philosophy, and it hurts my soul to say this as a philosopher, the literature can bridge a gap in a way that philosophical argument cannot. You can beat people left and right philosophically, but an image will make them change in a way that an argument never can. Because what's most at stake in making someone, I think, come into the faith, again, is not so much getting the right answers, but seeing the world as the church sees it. This is Francis Sheed, the guy who wrote, Theology and Sanity. He was the guy, he was in the 50s in the United Kingdom, and he would stand on the corner and just get in debates with people to bring them to the Catholic faith. Frank Sheed, excuse me. This is where Sheed and Ward, the publishers, come from. Anyway, this was his point, is that, you know, it's not just enough to fill in people with the answers. They need to see the world with the eyes of the church, which, of course, is with the mind of Christ. And you don't get the eyes of the church or the mind of Christ by getting it shoved into your head by argumentation. That's where the conversion, right? The word conversion, go back to the Greek, metanoia. What does it mean? It means to turn. And like, I don't know, there's many sermons preached on this, but to get to the basis of it, really for the Greeks, it meant you need to turn your head so you can see the direction that you weren't looking at. You have to have a different vision of things. You can hear the arguments until you're blue in the face, but unless you start to see the world through that lens, you'll never convert. Literature can provide images that arguments simply cannot. So I was bringing up the image of like the point about lust, right? That the contention, the problem with the church and the world about lust is not that they're ignorant, or not that like, you know, I mean, maybe we don't do a good enough job of saying it, but even when we do, we're not met with like plugged ears. We're met with blank expressions. What do you mean? What do you mean being driven by lust? Now, I'm not saying that like all we need to do is go look at Dante's Inferno and look where he talks about the lustful and everything will be fine. But I give us an example. When they get down into hell, this is the second or third, I think it's the second ring after limbo. The first people they run into are the lustful. And the lustful, their punishment is to be driven around by every wind without any control of their life. And the spirits, they look like birds that try to flap against the wind, but they can't, blown to and fro. And finally, Dante comes up to a pair of lovers who begin to talk about how none of this is their fault. None of this is our fault. We just loved each other. And the books, and they even throw shade at Dante. Poetry like you wrote did this to us. We didn't want to do this. All of the excitement of the poetry and how beautiful he was and how beautiful she was, we couldn't help ourselves. And God is at fault. One thing you'll notice about throughout the whole Inferno is the damned souls blame God continually for where they're at. It's never their fault. God did this to us. You did this to us, Dante. Someone else did, but the point is the image of being blown to and fro and never having any rest. Again, I want to reiterate, I'm not acting like if people will just read that verse, like, you know, just read this verse and they're like, oh, I'm not lustful anymore, the end. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that there's a way in which an image like that can maybe bridge where we can start talking about these things in a way that only an argument cannot. And remember, the point is not to give them answers they don't have. The point is to eventually get them to ask questions that they've never asked. And when it comes to something like lust, as big of a deal as it is in our culture, I'm telling you, the problem is not that they don't know the church's answers. They really don't know the church's questions. Why do you do this? Why do you think this is what you want? Why do you think you will be fulfilled living your life this way? And my only contention is something like Dante's Inferno, a little image like this, souls who can't even stand still long enough because they can't stop barking at someone else saying it's their fault. That's the image that the church has of lust. Not just some commandments, not just some wagging finger, but an entire group of souls who are so incapable of control of themselves that they're blown by every wind.
When you're talking about lust, are you talking about sexual lust, or are you talking about greed in other areas?
No, he's going to separate that out. So yeah, pretty much sexual lust. Oh, he gets really particular. Yeah, we'll talk about greed. He has punishments for all. I might as well bring up a point about Dante's Inferno specifically, but again, why literature can afford things that maybe an argumentation cannot. So in Dante's Inferno, you can sort of read the entire thing like it's a guy who basically wrote it a long poem as a vendetta, where he's like, here's my people in hell list. Lists 300 of them, write a fanciful poem about, like, revenge, about how they're getting hurt, the end. And I've heard people say Dante's a megalomaniac who just wanted to, like, because part of Dante's story where he writes the Divine Comedy, he's been exiled from his home. He'll never return. And it's all because of some pretty small ball, piddly, petty Italian politics. And so some people say he wrote the Divine Comedy just to really get the venom out. And that's really it. And this is a profoundly poor way to read the Inferno. Clearly, it's a pretty awesome move. I've always been like, maybe I should write an Inferno. This might be fun, but I don't have as many problems as Dante does. No. And it would mostly be me writing about, like, you should be here too, Bo. And that's one thing too, right, to point out. Dante has to seriously consider that he belongs there. Actually, what's funny is how many times in the Inferno that you'll be reading someone talking and it'll be like this really positive pep talk to Dante, and you realize that the person is trying to convince Dante to come to hell with them. And like, especially like, you'll get poets who are being punished for their vanity, and they'll just be like talking up Dante. You were the best. Now, and you have to think about like how kind of crazy this is. Dante has people in hell talking about how great he is. And Dante is not a meek man. He knows he's great. Everyone's told him. He basically invents modern Italian. But he has the temerity and ultimately the humility to realize that it's exactly people in hell stroking his vanity that is his greatest temptation. And so, like, it's weird, like, you'll see this through the Inferno again and again, that, like, the worst words are the sweetest ones. Like, the ones where people pop up and, like, start yelling at Dante, like, he faints sometimes, he's scared. But the ones that are truly the things he has to grow out of is he, like, really takes some compliments from some dudes in hell. And Virgil has to remind them, hey, by the way, they have to stay here forever. Do you really want to be like them? This reminds me of a silly Facebook meme where it's a calendar of inspirational Bible quotes, and one of them is, quote, if you will just worship me, I will give you all things. Luke, wherever that is. And it's pretty inspirational until you realize that Satan said that. So it's not an inspirational quote. Someone really dropped the ball on the inspirational calendar, right? And so Dante has, like, the Inferno has this line that people will quote where it will say, follow your star and I'm sure you will make it to the harbor where you belong, which sounds really great, except you realize it's a soul in hell who is stoking Dante's vanity. And exactly what Dante needs to be learning at that time is to not follow his own star. He needs to learn to be humble. So Dante, as much as we want, like some people want to say, like, oh, this is just a revenge fantasy, the person who, the character Dante in the book is the one who's constantly being berated for not being totally up to speed, as it were. So that's the fourth way I was saying that you can use literature as apologetics, is if we begin to read deeply of the best books, the great books, the classics, precisely what they do will give us images that we will use not so much to win arguments, but to present a vision of the moral life that the church has that some people have simply never seen for themselves. And again, I know this from people who've read The Inferno, even who are not Catholic, that they were like, I began to understand what Catholics meant by sin after reading The Inferno. It's not just being naughty. It's not just breaking the rules. It's destroying yourself. It's destroying yourself. And so this is one of the methods, I meant to bring this up a while ago and I got on a tangent. One of the methods Dante uses the entire time is counterpunctual torments or counterpunctual punishments. There's an Italian word to say that, but I'll mess it up. And I'm recording, so I'm not going to say it. But all of the punishments in hell are sort of a counterpunctual response to what the souls in hell did. So, for instance, at some point you get down, which circle it is. One of the problems with moving, I packed away my Dante books. So, good job, Bo. You'll be in the circle for forgetful idiots who don't plan ahead. Anyway, so what now? Yeah, that's a one way to put it. I like the counterpunctual because it's evocative of music. You know, so like the counterpunctual, like in a Bach fugue, right? So eventually the two lines of music like meet, and there's a way in which they're in sync with each other but not harmonious. And so, so.
You describe Bach really well.
Oh, thank you. I try. We'll do Bach next. No, anyway, what we were just talking about first with the lustful, right? The lustful who think they've taken charge of their life have actually been blown by the wind of lust. And so in hell, they can never stop being moved around because they can never be satiated. Because in life, that's what they wanted, was the satiation of lust. When you get down to the circle where there's the schismatics, they're all divided in some way. Like, famously, this is where Dante supposedly gets in trouble. Muhammad is broken half. Because for the medieval Italians, they thought Muhammad was a schismatic bishop. They didn't really know how Islam had started. So they thought Muhammad was a schismatic bishop from the 8th century. And so Dante has Muhammad riffed in half. He has someone, and then he has someone else. I might have a mix-up. Then he has someone else carrying their head. Because schism rips people in two. And in life, they enjoyed ripping in people in two. So in the underworld, they now will be riffed apart for all of eternity. All of these punishments, it's not just that they fit the crime, because this, again, that makes Dante sound like what he's into is the retribution. It's not that they fit the crime. It's that this is what people are doing to themselves. They just don't understand or get that. This is what people are doing to themselves. So famously, everybody, you know, when we think of the devil, pointy tail, red pitchfork, flames, in the Inferno, the ninth circle is encrusted in ice. And like poetically, it's because the devil in his great wings is trying so hard to escape hell that like the powerful winds of his wings freeze everything. but it's also because he lacks all love except self-love. So the devil is encased in ice, and all of the worst people, like the ninth circle of hell, is all traitors. For the medieval mind, the worst sin you can commit is being a traitor. The devil, the worst traitor. And then the devil has three jaws, and he's chewing Judas. Who are the two people that kill Julius Caesar? Claudius. No? Cassius, right. And so the ninth circle of hell is ice. Because for people who are fraudulent and traitors, the problem is not that they're exceptionally wicked, but that their hearts are cold as stone, and that love can't even motivate them to be good to the ones they should be good to the most. So this is this counterpoint, right? And so I've had people, this is me speaking from personal experience, but I think this happens more often than you realize. They read Dante's Inferno, and if they just have a little bit of guidance, they say, I finally realize what Catholics mean by sin. It's not you've been naughty, you've made God mad, you've just broke commandments or laws. It's that you think this is the ultimate form of self-destruction, and that the souls in hell don't need punished because they're punishing themselves. And I said, exactly right. Exactly right. But I could say that argument, and it just wouldn't be the same as reading it. So images from the great literature can bridge gaps that sometimes apologetic arguments cannot. The fifth and final way I think we can use literature is if you get the chance to read a book with someone, not that, you know, that ends up being a chance to make an apology for the faith. So it's not just that, like, okay, I'm going to take images from the book and then use them when certain arguments come up, but going through, right, being someone's Virgil to their Dante. So you should know this part of the book, but if not, Dante wakes up and finds himself in a dark wood in the middle of his life, and he thinks there's no way out. And every way he looks to escape, there's three beasts that cut him off at every pass. And the three beasts are usually seen as the three types of sin that we're going to encounter again in hell. Lust, wrath, and malice. So sins of incontinence, sins against others through violence, and sins against others through malice, intellectual hatred, as it were. So you get the leopard, the she-lion, and the wolf. And they're waiting for the greyhound to come and save him. But the greyhound's not coming, and he thinks his life is lost. One of these great beasts is going to devour him, and he'll be dead. When lo and behold, he kind of gets a tap on his shoulder, and he's like, hey, don't worry, I'm here. I'll help you out. And he's like, oh, thank you. You know, you look familiar. Who are you? You know, you kind of look like a Roman with a poet's laurel crown on. Who are you? And Vinny eventually figures out it's Virgil, right? Virgil is his Dante's hero when it comes to poetry and stuff like this. And so then we get one of the best bro adventure stories of all of Western literature, right? His two buddies go through hell. Okay, sorry. But we get exactly this friendship of going through it together. Not only that, because Dante is not up to see what hell is about, because he doesn't know what's going on, and Virgil's, you know, dead, and he knows what's going on, things like this. But as a metaphor, what Dante's saying is, when I read Virgil in real life, Virgil was a guide for me through the Christian life. And he accompanied me through hell and purgatory, and then passed me off to the saints to get me to the illumination of heaven. That's what we're called to do sometimes, I think, if we go this fifth route, where it's an apologetic situation that we read some of these great works together with someone else and try to be their Virgil to their Dante. Now, I know most of us are not up for being Virgil. You know, most of us aren't poets, and we know it. And that's the last rhyme we'll ever make that makes sense in our lives. So I'm not saying that we need to be as brilliant as Virgil, or that we need to be, you know, that well known. But precisely one of the ways that you can actually read through the comedy that starts to be very interesting is how gentle, alternating with stern, Virgil is with Dante. And I actually think you could read the entire book and say, this is what it's like to be a good friend. To be a good friend. To be a good friend who's going through quite an ordeal. Remember when you were with your friend, you're like, hey, remember that one time you woke up and you were in hell? I helped you out. Yeah, that was great, wasn't it? You owe me. No, but at any rate, so. But figuratively, sometimes we accompany people through hell. And we have a lot to learn if we could just be someone's Virgil to someone else's Dante. But that's sort of the thing that we would do if we would take up reading literature with someone as an opportunity for apologetics. You're not going to go through and be like, oh, that's what you thought the third canto was about? Well, that's cute, but you're wrong. I'm going to get out the big old Catholic explanation and show you how you're an idiot, and then you'll convert. Okay, again, not so worried about the answers, worried about making them asking the right questions. But this actually goes back to how I was supposed to sort of make this about Advent. I had a lot of stuff going on here. Apologetics, Dante, Advent. Advent, oh, what a misunderstood season. I think what I talked about last year, I don't need to repeat. Here we are supposed to be in the second most penitential season of the church, and we're getting candy canes and Sacristan smiles shoved in our face. And we're like, you know, we want to be sort of expecting the Lord, but I can't dodge Rudolph's if I tried. What makes Advent different than Lent, too, right? You know, that starts to be something as well. And actually, it was last year, 2 years ago, one of the things I did for Lent was actually read Dante's Purgatory. I read the Purgatorio through Lent, read a canto a day. And the Purgatory very much being a very dynamic book talking about how it is we can change, how we can shift from a life of sin to a life of salvation is very instructive to do during Lent. So when people go like, oh, okay, well, Advent's sort of like a little Lent. What are you going to read? You know, it has to be a little bit nicer than Purgatory. I'm like, no. Inferno. Inferno for Advent. They're like, hell for Advent? But people are singing about Rudolph, and you want to talk about hell. And I'm like, exactly. This is the time to talk about hell. Why? Because the awaiting, the long-awaited Messiah is a lot like Dante waking up in the middle of his life in a dark wood, not knowing which way to turn, blocked off at all sides by three beasts that are sin, that he had no way to go. When you sing, O Come, Emmanuel, now the verses are actually from the O Antiphons that we're going to start singing here pretty soon. I think start December 17th. But, you know, when you sing that first verse, you know, it's always cute. The kids, they can sing, you know, come, O come, Emmanuel, ransom captive Israel. We're always, like, smiling because it's kids. But then we need to stop and go, like, oh, ransoming captive Israel, that sounds pretty hardcore. Ransom captive Israel, who mourns in lonely exile here until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel will come to thee, O Israel. Oh, perfect Advent song. Because the first century Jews, before Jesus came, thought they were in captivity and needed ransom. They were in a dark wood that they had awoken of in the middle of their life with this God of theirs, and they didn't know which way to go. And all you need to do is study a little bit first century politics at the time of the Jewish people to understand how utterly confused they all were about what should happen next. The Sadducees saying that we should sell out to the Romans wholesale because the Romans at least protect us. The Pharisees saying like, no, we need to double down on this following law business. The Essenes being like, we're going to go out to the woods, eat locusts, yahoo, right? And then there's other people who are forming militias because they think they need to violently storm Rome. And that's just like the four major ones. There's even more divisions than this. This is Israel waking up in the middle of life in a dark wood, not knowing where to go. And what they need is a guide. And John the Baptist is this Virgil-like character who comes and says, the one who is coming, I cannot tie his sandal. I'm not worthy to untie his sandal. But it's now the time to level that which is not straight, to make the path straight for the coming of the Lord. And the reason that Dante's Inferno, I think, is a very great Advent text, even if all you do is read it, but if you try to garner images from it or read it with someone else, is that that reckoning that John has been calling us to, especially in the first two Sundays of Advent, the John the Baptist saying that he is coming with his winnowing fork to separate the head from the chaff, and the chaff he will throw into the unquenchable fire. When we hear John say that, we shouldn't go like, good, he's getting rid of that chaff, you know, sitting in the back of church, taking up two spots, unlike me, the kernel of the wheat, all nice and shiny. No, no, no. John's saying, you, in your own heart, what is chaff and what is worthy to be saved? And what Virgil says to Dante, how this all goes through, is Beatrice, his love and life, we'll bring her up in the next two times, that Beatrice goes to the Virgin Mary and intercedes for Dante, who was lost, and the Virgin sends St. Lucy to literally pluck, like in the theory of the book, pluck Virgil out of limbo to go save Dante. And what does Dante need to do in order to save himself? He needs to come to terms with sin. He needs to come to terms with sin. Notice that the answer in this book that Dante thinks, he's lost in a dark wood. What he doesn't need is like, no, 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 let's go show you heaven so that, like, you know that there's better stuff and attain it. Virgil says, on order of the authority of heaven itself, I'm to take you through hell so you know what sin is like, why you should change. Why do we read the Old Testament? In all of its multifaceted craziness, wonderful craziness. Why did God allow the people of Israel to go through what they did on our behalf? Because we must come to terms with sin, and we have to come to terms with it in our life. And because before we do that, we can't go through purgatory, and we certainly can't go through heaven. Advent is the time of mourning and lonely exile. Mourning and lonely exile. And that's funny because you go like, but everybody's so sweet and happy. This is the most wonderful time of the year. Unless you're a teacher and you're finishing grades. Teachers understand Advent being purgatorial more than you guys do. Sorry. No, I'm joking. But mourns and lonely exile here. You know what exile's like? It's like a lot of people trying to tempt you with Rudolphs and peppermints and this sort of faux nice sweetness that sometime in the 1950s was invented about Christmas. Well, Dickens didn't help too. I'm sorry. I'm officially on record throwing Charles Dickens under the bus here a bit. Just for this part. But notice this, right? That like what we start to have is Christmas light, L-I-T-E, right? Which is the precursor to Christianity light, L-I-T-E, right? That what Christianity has been sort of, you know, people will allow Christianity of what we mean is that religion that makes you nice to other people. But don't talk about it in public. Don't be mean to anyone else. Don't show the cross with an executed God on it. Nice Christianity. Advent is the season of Christmas light, nice Christmas. When are we supposed to celebrate the 12 days of Christmas? Starts December 25th. We're supposed to party on through January 6th. What happens in America by December 25th? People have gained 40 pounds. They throw out their trees. They burn all of their bonbons, right, that they've received this whole time. We have it backwards. World's always had it backwards. I'm not trying to act like it's worse. World's always had it backwards. We have an easy example of it being backwards. Advent is the time where we recall we're waiting for our ransom. We're mourning in exile. Our King is coming, but we have to reckon with this mourning if we're really going to be prepared for the King when he comes. And all I'm trying to throw out with my example, I guess, is that you can tell people that, and they'll just think you're being bah humbug. It's funny how much, you know, how much I love Christmas. I now get to be the person who's like Scrooge, because I'm like, no, let's maybe put up the Christmas tree closer to December 25th and leave it up. How dare you, Bo? Do you hate children? Right. But if we mourn in lonely exile here, then we'll be prepared for all the Christmas, the true music of Christmas, when it comes. And my only point is, this is really hard for people to see, but when they read something like the Inferno, and I'm not acting like the Inferno is the only example, but when they read something like the Inferno, they might get a glimpse of what we're talking about. Mourning in lonely exile, that they just won't get another way. So my hope is, the next two Tuesdays, are we skipping one? We have the next one, or is it three in a row at this point? Three in a row at this point. My hope is that through the next three, we can also point out a few more of these images from the Inferno, talk about them, how they might be useful, what they might be useful about, what they have to do with Advent, what they have to do with Christmas. But like I said, this was my preamble one, emphasis on ramble. So I'll stop for now and see if there's any questions that you guys have, or if you're just convinced that I'm Scrooge and I'm trying to ruin Christmas. Just let me know. Questions? Because I've gotten that argument, not an argument. People have been like, "Why is it 12 days of Christmas?" Right? Because they're like, "Isn't it like from Thanksgiving forward? That's not 12 days." No, I'm joking. But you know, they're like, "Where does this 12 days come from?" And you're like, "No. December 25th, January 6th. It was literally 12 feast days. Like you have the Christmas octave, those 8 days, and then you had like, I mean, you have so many feasts in that whole time. Saint Stephen." Good King's Wendelislaus, Feast of the Holy, what? Holy Family, Circumcision of Jesus, what is it now? Mary, Mother of God. Used to be the Circumcision of Jesus. That's actually a fun one to pull off to your Protestant friends, because it's still technically also the Feast of the Circumcision of Jesus. Just go into work January 1st. Happy Circumcision of Jesus! Everyone's like, what? It's like, first shed blood that he ever shed for us. That used to be one of the hymns that was sung about it. We anyway. But thank you, Patrick. I do. The 12 days of Christmas. I don't know if we're all going to have turtle doves and stuff like that, but I haven't seen a turtle dove in a while.
Christmas is a religious day.
Yes. Well, yeah, so you get countries split it in two ways. It's either St. Nicholas, so December 6th. So we actually do that to get our presents out of the way, because we know grandparents are going to inundate them on the 25th. Or other people do it Epiphany Day. It's, yeah, so January 5th Eve into January 6th. But other countries have all sorts of cool stuff. Ours is all like very Coca-Cola Santa Claus is our Christmas. In Austria, they have Krampus. Have you guys heard of Krampus? Krampus is the demon that St. Nicholas threw a rope around and made do his bidding. And so how this eventually gets worked out in Austria is that he goes around and chases the bad children and, like, hits them in the leg with a stick. And they're going around going, "Bitter, bitter," I think is it. It's like, "Pray, pray." And so, like, they have these, like, they do this. It's all out in the street. And if you start getting whacked by someone in, like, a goblin outfit, you have to get down and say a Pater Noster. And so, like, I was reading someone who's this happened to, and he's like, "It's really hard." You're like, "Our Father," you know. But when you get done, he's like, "Krampus, way better than St. Nick's Day." So anyway, we should be partying a lot more. Completely agree with that. I'm not saying that that necessarily means that like Lent and Advent are going to look exactly the same, because even they don't classically, even again, I think the monks who usually are examples of the more sort of hardcore version of whatever we should be doing, they go back a little bit in Advent, but it's not like Lent. But it should be a time of expectation. And I mean, I don't know, like that's maybe where I sound like an old fogey. I mean, I remember in the 80s, we didn't get anything nice until Christmas Eve. Now it seems like, I mean, shoot, just at work, man, I'm not going to complain, but there's like a Christmas party every 30 minutes. So, you know, I'm all like, I'll get these calories in mournful exile, I guess. Now, other questions or observations? Yes. See, and this is a good example. I mean, that's a very good issue to bring up about what I'm talking about. Plenty of people know the talking points, quote-unquote, on each side. So, you know how someone was making a joke about, like, Americans speaking to foreign people who speak other languages? Like, the joke is something to the effect of, like, oh, I have laryngitis, so I'm not going to be able to yell, so foreign people won't be able to understand me, right? Because Americans somehow think that if you talk louder, English is easier to understand, which it's not. Well, we do that with these big intractable debates. So we give our piece about abortion, and they hear, and they're like, I don't agree. And you're like, oh, let me try this again. Abortion is wrong! You know, so like yelling or just repeating it's not going to ultimately work. There are people that the reason they're on the other side than the Catholic Church on this issue is because they're misinformed. And sometimes the best thing you can do is be a friend with a person like that so that finally they'll simmer down and listen to you. They're like, I know you don't like who's on the TV, but you know me. I won't lie to you. Here's the argument. Maybe they hear it for the first time. But I really think for a lot of them it's this. They don't see it like we do. And I don't mean that they don't understand the argument. It's that the world looks completely different to them. And that they don't fathom what we're talking about. There's no magic bullet to this. There's no, like I said, if it was, there would just be this book and we'd hand it out and like we'd like just hold them down, read, right? And then they do it and they're like, oh, I'm wrong, my bad. But that doesn't work that way. But there is something, and Dante's Inferno might be it. There might be other stories that people begin to see how the church sees some of those things. All of this, the reason it's unsatisfying and it doesn't get spoken of very much is it's all deeply unsatisfying because it involves a lot of patience. It involves a lot of mourning and exile. Because, you know, that starts to be part of the reality of Advent, right? We're remembering what it's like to be the Jewish people waiting for the Messiah. But what else are we doing? We're waiting for the second coming. And like we have to do two things, right? We have to say, come, Lord Jesus, come, and mean that. And how many times do we really mean that? Because we're like, come, Lord Jesus, come, after the game. Yeah, it's a really important game. You know, just let Oklahoma State win one national championship, then the world can end, right? In football. Yeah, okay, so, you know, how serious are we about that? But then the other one is to mean it non-vindictively. Like, we're like, oh, those people, I wish Jesus would come back. Punt them like a football. No, what we mean is, all of the people who suffer, do we really mean, come, Lord Jesus, come? We're waiting in mournful exile, because ultimately, all the questions we could come up with, abortion, to anything else, like, we will not be the ultimate victors. It will only be with Jesus Christ returning. That doesn't mean that we should be quietist and do nothing, But it also should mean that we have to understand how we're to witness to these things. And it's slow and it's patient and it is mournful. If you have worked a lot of your life trying to be a good witness for pro-life and not a lot have come from it, know that they did the same to the prophets and the apostles. You're just going to have to get used to Jesus giving consolation that way. It's never, very rarely, ecstatic consolation. It's, if they did it to the Master, why wouldn't they do it to us? Yes?
So, when you were talking about Israel and the desperation that people felt, they didn't know what they were waiting for. I thought you were talking about Syria and the Middle East.
That's right. I mean, the sad thing, when I think about this in the way of the cross, like I'm looking at these now over here on the wall, where Jesus turns to the women of Jerusalem and says, like, even less for me, I cry for you. And it seems like that was a prophecy Jesus said about the Holy Land that's basically never stopped for almost 2,000 years unending. And there's been relative peace, I'm not denying that, depending on various areas. But no, I mean, if you need a factual reminder of what it means, mourning and lonely exile, all you need to do is see any picture of Aleppo bombed to ruin. All you need to do is look at Libya, a smoking dust pile. All of those places used to be the most populous Christian nations on all of Earth. And now they are almost all driven out. Who mourns in lonely exile? I mean, we have too many examples if we'll be willing to think about them. Now, one thing that, you know, I try to, like, throw on both sides of an issue like this. I remember when the Paris bombings happened and people were like, well, what about, like, all these bad things that happen in these other countries? And I like to remind people, look, for most of human history, you wouldn't have known about 98% of the things that happen in life. Mostly because, I'll at least speak for me, Bonners were probably peasants, right? Weren't reading newspapers. We're like, I'm just worried about making this pig go over there and then drinking, right? That's mostly Bonners for most of human history. You would maybe hear about 1 out of 10 of those things. But the fact of the matter is, all of those people were so much more acquainted with pain and suffering in a way that we can act like we're not. Then I want to go back the other way and say, no, it really is, we really should have the gift of tears and prayer. If not for everyone in the world, because we just simply can't manage doing that, at least for our Christian brothers and sisters. And that's not meaning that, like, we hate anyone else because we don't think of them first. I'm certainly not saying that. But we're human. We have a responsibility to care about those in a descending order, our families, our communities, our co-religionists, our this, our that, and we too easily make O Come Emmanuel like it's a happy song. I mean, it's just, I think that's a metaphor that we should keep in mind. We act like it's just one more happy song, and it is a song about mournful exile. Now, what I'm not saying is that you need to go into work tomorrow. Sorry, Bo said I can't smile. But no cookies. You just go up and just crush the cookies while you're singing O Come Emmanuel, just looking at people. This is what Bo said to do. No, it's not what I said to do. But we have to do both. We have to do both. Anybody else?
Yeah,
yes?
I have one. What about when you're talking with, like you said, you get a lot of just kind of vacant stares sometimes when you're talking about sin and how is so disruptive to one's life and stuff. And I think of talking to my own son who was raised in the Catholic Church, kindergarten through 12th grade. And he's 23, thinks he knows everything.
Mm-hmm.
But Mom, I'm a good person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a good person.
Yeah.
You know, so how do you, you know, he's...
There's so many good 23-year-olds.
I'm a good person. doesn't matter that what I'm doing makes mom cringe, but I'm a good person, you know? And how do you discuss that with them and try to get them interested, whether it's a 23-year-old or a 50-year-old, the good person argument?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a real, I love that putting it that way. There's two things. One is the work that we need to be doing in a more structural way, which again is to say Christianity is not about making good people. That's not our point. Like, we don't play like a civic role where we make it like we're going to make good workers who drink Starbucks, tap on keys, and then die, right? Like, we're not population control, right? Which will sometimes, that's what people will act like. Someone put out an article a while ago, and I think that they've debunked the science, but I thought it was great. Someone was like, they had proof that religious children were more selfish and mean than secular children. And, like, there were people getting really worried. And I was all like, yeah, because they know what sin means. It's like, I've met little kids running around at VBS. They all have brothers and sisters. They know how to steal, right? I mean, otherwise they don't get anything right now. But, like, I was telling people, I'm like, why are you worried about that? Like, I mean, like, maybe we do make little hellions a bit because they get ideas from, like, Jacob and stuff like that in the Bible. I don't know. But my point being is, that idea worrying us is exactly wrong. Like, we were worried that we didn't make good little compliant children instead of, do people know they're sinners in need of a Savior? But more to, like, now you have a 23-year-old in front of you who says they're a good person. I don't know. This might not be, maybe I'm not the person to answer that, because on one hand, I'm close to their age. On another, I teach a lot of them. So maybe my patience has grown thin. Or maybe it's that, like, it will be different depending on who you're talking about. But befriending a lot of these 20-somethings, like in the Catholic Church here in Wichita, part of it is that, like, you show them that you truly have their interest in mind, that you can be a friend, but then you also make sure to rib them when they deserve it. But that's probably not what a mom should do. It's probably not what people in their 50s maybe should do. I mean, there's different things different people should do in all these ways. And I think that is one thing really missing for a lot of the youth, is there needs to be, like, the older brother / younger uncle who can call them out on their business when it stops being mom and dad's turn to do so. And we've lost a lot of that, and that's just the fragmentation of society and a lot of things like this. But I mean, I don't know, this gets into, like, Bo's theory of raising children, which either will earn me a lot of money in a book or get my children taken away someday. But I really think we kind of get this backwards. Like, everybody's really nice to little kids because they're cute, and then they grow up, and then they're teenagers, and then we're like, oh, I don't like them anymore. So I harp on them, right? And I kind of think you need to do it the opposite way. When it's kids, most people are nice to your children, right? My children all act better for other people. But what they need is sort of like a preternatural remembrance that mom and dad are authorities and they tell them what to do. And then when they start growing up, becoming teenagers and getting, like, ugly and weird looking and, like, difficult to deal with, that's actually where parents can actually start to be something other than, because the world is going to nag on you till you're dead. This is what I'm getting at, right? When you become adult, that's why I tell these college kids, I'm like, you know what being an adult is like? Imagine you get kicked to the ground and then they keep kicking. You're an adult. I was like, and you have to hope that, like, by the time they get to the ninth rib, their foot hurts and they stop. You're an adult now. Right? So the world is full of people who will kick you when you're down. And that's actually when, funny enough, mom and dad should probably be friends. But there needs to be older brothers, sisters, younger aunts and uncles, that they're the ones who'd be like, I'm not much different than you. I was, you know, this isn't like mom and dad when they were doing something in ancient times. This just happened to me. You need to buck up. But it takes, this is why it does take a whole variety of a community to do this. And hopefully, I mean, the other thing that they've talked about that we were trying to get off the road, and I just, you know, I ended up leaving in January, is it's really going to take a lot of the 20-somethings to form communities that hold each other accountable, people their own age. They don't have what even people 30 years ago had, where you knew everybody, you knew most everyone in a certain mile radius, and, like, gossip can be evil, but it can also make you decide, like, I probably shouldn't just bring the mistress to the front door because everyone will see and talk about it, right? Well, we live in such a fragmented society where you can almost do whatever you want and no one will know. So people are going to have to willingly hold each other accountable. And that was something that I, you know, young adult ministry, we haven't figured out what to do. We sometimes treat them like they're glorified CYOs. And then the rest of the time we're like, just get married so we can put you in the altar society. We don't know what to do. And what we need to do is challenge them to hold them each other accountable and say, we think you're up to it. But you're right. What they hear is like, well, I'm a good person. What they mean is like, I haven't murdered anyone. And I was like, well, I haven't murdered anyone either. I've done tons of terrible stuff. Well, it's like, I'm 34, have loads of regret, and have not shot a single person, right? So just because you haven't murdered someone, 23-year-old, doesn't mean that there's not sin in your life you need to look at. But it takes different people saying that to them, and it might not be mom and dad who should. That's right.
That's, I think, a lot of times it comes from outside sources, you know, that, just like you said, that hold them accountable.
That's right. I don't know. I mean, I'm already, like, planning things I'm going to say to them is, like, I love all sorts of, you know, like, some of my favorite football teams are just, you know, screw-ups, and I still love them, so of course I love you, son and daughter. It's like, I love all sorts of things that are really disappointing and never turn out how I am. I love you. On record, I'm joking. Anybody who's listening at home, that's a joke. That's like, right, yeah, like, yeah. What? No, that's fine. That's why you should like sports teams. Well, you, most of you are Chiefs fans. You know what this is like, right? Bang, bang. Okay, sorry. Anyway. Anybody else? Anybody? I mean, Trump has probably said a lot of stuff. I could just start ranting, and like you can get the general effect.
I just had a comment. You know, I'm a recent convert, and I have one sister left, and the rest of my brothers and sisters are dead. But I didn't tell her that I was converting until after the last Easter vigil.
Mm-hmm. That's what I grew up with, yep,
you know,
yep.
Mm-hmm. And she said, well, finally came out and said, why?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I got interested because of one friend and because of the things I'm reading about the Pope. And so I started going through RCI, and I said it was like a pregnancy. You know, you used to go in for 9 months of training, and
I think that's a really good way to put it, yes. That's right. Like the first trimester, you're throwing up, you're kind of queasy. I think you're right. Yeah.
Well,
you know, like I said, there's all sorts of ways you can go with this. One of the things is to throw out a big egghead sounding word to explain what you're talking about. People are mimetic creatures. The Greek word for mimesis means like we're imitating, like we learn through imitation. This explains all the way back to when you're a baby and you learn to talk. People go like, how do you teach a kid to learn to talk? You know, it's not that like you're like Vanna White and you point out stuff. Ball, car, right? But what you do is you just talk at the kid, you know. And the more kids you have, of course, the more crazy people probably think you are. Like when you're at Walmart and you have the like 6-month-old and you're like, oh, what do you think? Should I buy this? Right? Like, why do you do that? Because kids learn through mimesis. They imitate. And then we imitate each other. And all sociological data we have about people converting is it's mimetic chains. They actually say the closest thing it parallels is infections. Like, people get infected with the gospel. Now, the reason this is, though, is like, so people like will act like, oh, this is so problematic sounding. But this is who we are. Where did you learn to do anything that you did? And you saw it or you heard it from someone in your group. And when enough people did it or the right people did it, you at least considered it. Now, peer pressure, you know, we usually talk against peer pressure, but that's usually because mimetic theory, like especially when you have like 10-year-old boys involved, like mimesis is pretty stupid, right? So they're imitating some dumb stuff. So what we have to teach them is like imitate, but we don't tell kids not to imitate. We do, but that would be silly. What we need to tell them is like, no, imitate the right people. And if you'll notice, St. Paul does this all the time. He specifically says that, imitate me as I imitate Christ. Imitate me as I imitate Christ. And now, you know, there's all sorts of host of things in apologetics that, like, we have to be quick to point out. You can be like, you know, whoever you're talking to, I try my best, I fail, but, you know, that's why we have the saints. The reason we don't only have Jesus is because we have a lot of saints who are out-and-out failures before they became who they were. Like, that's why we have the apostles. The whole point of the gospel is to be like, hey, you know the 12 most important people after Jesus? Big failures. Until the Holy Spirit took a hold of them and made them who they were. We just can include loads and loads of people, right, about how this happens. So apologetics is mimetic. It's imitation. Which also is just another way to point out what I was saying. That's why it's important to get people to ask right questions instead of just give them answers. Because what they're going to start doing is like, why, like a good question is, why are you the sixth person that I've heard convert to the Catholic faith recently? That's a good question. But funny enough, it also can work for people in the pews. The other day, we had the low mass and the extraordinary rite for the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. So the old Latin mass. You know, old codgers like me like going to it. we had it, and it was great, because Father Yurok's there, and I'm guessing 3/4, if not more, people were like, what's going on? Like, they didn't know, right? And they're like, and so I was talking to Father afterwards, and he's like, you know, we told all sorts of people, we told that was going to happen. I was like, Father, you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb and say that might be the best thing that's happened for lots of people, because for the first time in their life, their faith made them uncomfortable. And they had to ask the good question, what am I doing here? Which is a fabulous question for us all to ask. What are we doing in the Mass? Yeah.
I know you're probably pressed for time, but a lot of times things are built on success. And I've got a cold, so I apologize for that.
Never.
Anyway, I've got a pretty good story for you. I met a guy in a McDonald's restaurant. And kind of got to know him a little bit. And it's really a tragedy. He was a member here at West Sacrament. He quit going to church. It's a real, I'm not going to go into details, but a very, very tragic story. And he was so bitter. And, I tried to talk to him. You always ask yourself, what are you going to say? What are you going to do? And he was so bitter on the inside, he didn't want to listen to anything. And I told him, I said, Joe, I said, you got to fix yourself before you fix anybody else. And so then I had the idea. We had a great book here that we gave out for a parish mission, and it was Searching for and Maintaining Peace. Mm-hmm.
The best book you've done, other than the Bible, in my opinion, by the way.
I'm not going to tell all that, too, but it's a long story. I'd seen him a couple times previous, but I didn't really want to push him on anything.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you kind of sense when the time's right to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw him about 2 weeks ago, and I said, I didn't say anything. He said, hey, I read that book you gave me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it's a great book. And he could almost recite every chapter of that book, what was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, I said, well, that's great. I said, you know, one of these days when we go through RCIA again, I'd like to have you come back and get back into the church again. And he said, I'll do that. So, you know, just compassionate, caring for people goes a long ways. But I thought, you know, they kind of fit in with what we're talking about today. So the right book, the right person at the right time.
And also, you know, being nimble enough to avoid the book when it's getting thrown at you. No, I mean, like I said, I think that's a great example. And the freedom of, like, not thinking that there's some technique we need to do to pull it off. Because, like, you know, like, at the minute that he threw it off, you know, threw it out and you walked away, one thing you could have done was, like, really grilled yourself, like, what did I do wrong? As if there was some method you could have done where it was right. But if you give that up to God and you go, like, it's not up to me, yeah, then God, like, you know, I don't know when he went and picked it back up. My guess, a dog got it and ran after it. No, that's if it was a movie. Sorry, anyway. But no, my point being is, like, yeah, you don't, but, like, if you give up worrying about, like, that I need to be this sort of method in control, blah, 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 then, yeah, apologetics, like I said, not a method. Half the time, not about the questions, not the answers we give, but helping them to ask the right questions. And I'm that guy, with that book, I'm sure the question it eventually made him ask, why am I so bitter? So, all right, well, it's 8:30, so we went 30 minutes over, so I really should let you guys go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.